We're about to meet the accomplished historian and best-selling author Tom Holland, who's written several books on antiquity, including Persian Fire, a history of the Greco-Persian Wars, and Rubicon, about the rise and fall of the Roman Empire. He's also a distinguished broadcaster. He presents the BBC Radio 4's programme Making History, and he's made television documentaries exploring everything from dinosaurs to the roots of Islam. In other words, Tom is a man who likes to take a panoramic view of history, very much a polymath. It's no surprise then that his latest book, Dominion, finds him delving deep into the 2,000-year lifespan of Christianity. But he's quick to point out his new book is not intended to be a history of Christianity. It is, he says, a history of what's been revolutionary and transformative about Christianity, of how it's shaped Western civilization, no less. And he joined me earlier from the ABC's London studio.
Thank you very much for having me back.
Tom, was there a distinct trigger point that you can identify that prompted this extraordinarily ambitious undertaking, delving into the and trying to make fresh this 2,000-year-old history?
Well, it's absolutely rooted in my own past. And I guess one of the themes of the book is that almost everybody in the West does have a kind of personal relationship to the history of Christianity, be you a believer or be you an atheist. In my own case, I was raised a Christian. My mother, very devout Anglican, so I went to church, unbelievably sang in the choir, went to Sunday school. But to be honest, I found it faintly boring. And my real passions were, first of all, dinosaurs and then the Roman Empire. And both of them were kind of fierce and glamorous and extinct. And I just found it kind of much more exciting, I suppose, than...
And masculine.
There were ferocious female dinosaurs and terrifying Roman empresses as well. I mean, that was all part of the swirl of the glamour. Mm. But if you'd asked me, whose side was I on, Jesus or Pontius Pilate, I would totally have gone with Pontius Pilate with his eagles and his purple and everything. So it wasn't so much that I dramatically lost my faith. It was more like a kind of dimmer switch slowly being turned down. And when I came to write history, my focus was absolutely on those childhood passions. So it was the great empires, the kind of apex predators of antiquity. But I found over the course of many years trying to get inside the minds of the Spartans or the Romans, that I found them, actually, these were not the people who were my kind of ideological ancestors, as I'd thought. And I discovered that the civilizations that had seemed so glamorous to me as a child, as an adult, I began to find them actually quite frightening. And I began to think, what is it that explains the absolute chasm of difference, emotional, ideological, on almost every linguistic, on almost every level, that exists between me and the world that I inhabit and antiquity? And the more that I thought about it, it was kind of like, when you have an itch on the back and you try and find it. And then when you locate it and you scratch it and great, I've got there. I began to realize that almost everything that made me derived not from classical Greek philosophy, not from Roman imperialism, but from Christianity, this kind of strange cuckoo in the classical nest that ended up transforming it utterly, and whose heirs really, I think, all of us in the West are.
Well, in fact, you've got this wonderful line that all of our contemporary Western moral and social norms are the product of this Christian revolution of the mind, and these are my words, almost you paint the picture of the ultimate disruptors, disruption's the great word of the moment. The Greeks and Romans are, in ethical terms, as remote from us as giant lizards. So you found, did you, that there was this extraordinary chasm that existed between that old world and the world that the Christians influenced?
Well, it's important to emphasize that, I mean, nothing comes from nothing. So Christianity is a fusion of many different elements, most obviously the Jewish inheritance. Mm. But Greek philosophy, for instance, is a crucial constituent part. So is the great tradition of Persian dualism, the habit of seeing the cosmos as divided between rival forces of good and evil. And indeed, Roman imperialism itself, which is a kind of great globalizing force and claims a universal status for itself. This provides the kind of petri dish in which all these various elements can mix and mingle. But I do think that the kind of product, if you like, that emerges is something distinctive and is something transformative and revolutionary. And if you want one symbol of that, it's the really obvious one. It's probably the most internationally recognized cultural symbol that humanity has ever devised, and that's the cross. And the cross to the Romans is an emblem of power. It's a symbol of their right to torture to death and humiliate very horribly anyone who opposes them. And specifically, the cross is an emblem of the power of the master over a slave. To die on a cross is paradigmatically the fate of a slave, of the very lowest of the low. And so the way in which Christianity transforms this emblem of power into an emblem of the triumph of the powerless over the powerful is an absolutely perfect symbol of what you, as you say, its role as the great disruptor in world civilization.
Yes. By the way, I just want to go to the Jewish inheritance. Where do you place the Jewish background, that seedbed, which I think a lot of us in the who still do participate in Christianity are sort of realizing more and more that it's fundamentally the grandfather religion, the Hebrew religion. Well, so I just wonder where you put that.
Well, you see, in that question, there are all kinds of ways in which you recognize that English as a language saturated in Christianity kind of almost obliges you to see antiquity in a kind of anachronistic way, because the concept of religion is a very distinctively Christian one. And the notion of there having been a religion called Judaism that preceded a religion called Christianity is something that, that Christians have always assumed. The word Judaismos, Judaism in the sense that we use it today, is coined by Christians in the second century, but no Jew uses it until the 19th century. So I think that when we look at the world into which Jesus is born, there is a word, Judaismos, a Greek word, but I think it doesn't mean Judaism. It means Jewishness, the quality of being a Jew. So if we look at Judaismos in the world that Jesus is born into, I think it's best to think of it not as a religion, but as a kind of bandwidth. And at one end of the bandwidth, you have Jews who emphasize the role of their God as the God of Israel. He is the particular patron of the Jews. At other end, you have, and this is particularly the case in the kind of the globalized world of Rome, you have Jews who emphasize the role of their God as the creator of all humanity, who's fashioned the entire cosmos. And what essentially happens over the course of the first century AD is that kind of span splits, and people who emphasize the role of the Jewish God as the creator of all humanity take the Christian course. And those who emphasize the role of the Jewish God as the God of Israel take the course that will lead them to become what we now call rabbinical Judaism.
So St. Paul would be in the first group.
Paul is the first Christian writer that we have. He's the first person to talk about this extraordinary notion that this condemned criminal who suffered the death of a slave is in some way part of the one God who fashioned the entire cosmos. And it's, you know, that is what makes his teachings distinctive and unique. And yet he is, in his idea that the Jewish God has created all of humanity, that is something that many other Jews also are very interested in and are promoting. So Christianity is simultaneously transformative and radical, but it is also clearly rooted in this great inheritance, which is why there comes to be a New Testament, but also an Old Testament.
Fascinating. How revolutionary do you say Christianity was then in its early form?
Well, I think that maybe in two ways it's transformative, but again, both of those are drawing on things that already existed. So Paul is for instance, is revolutionary because he is saying that there is now a covenant that joins everybody with God. So the Jews had the law written on tablets of stone given to Moses exclusively for them. But now there is a law that is written on the heart. And Paul reaches for a phrase from Greek philosophy, synodesis, conscience, to explain this. It's the spark of the divine that exists within every human being. And Paul frames this as being the illumination of the spirit that enables people to look into their hearts and to see what is written there. And that implies that there is a kind of universal sense that spans the world of good and evil, that people know by looking into their hearts.
And that didn't exist before?
It kind of existed. It's kind of there in the philosophy of the Stoics, who believe that the spark of the divine is imminent in everything. But Paul gives it this new twist because he joins it with the idea, you know, that this is a law given by God and that now everybody can share in it. And so, as he famously says, there is no Greek or Jew. Those differences are dissolved. And that is really the kind of the foundational idea of the kind of the current Western ideal, that we are indeed all, you know, all human beings are equal. Equally radical is what is emphasized in the figure of Jesus on the cross, the idea that the weakness can overcome strength.
And but isn't this what is so fascinating and that you write about? The Romans, just their attitude to power, it was so comprehensive, and it's just light years away from where we are now. You can debate this,
yeah.
I suppose.
Yeah, well... Yeah, well, Paul says that this is to the Romans is going to seem madness, and he recognizes how insanely radical this, you know, the idea that a crucified slave could be a god is. It's not the idea that a man can become a god that is unusual. Augustus Caesar, the emperor who is ruling the world when Jesus is born, himself is the adopted son of Julius Caesar, who's become a god. Augustus becomes a god when he dies. He rises into heaven. He sits at the right hand of his father. You know, none of this is odd. What is odd is the idea that it's a crucified slave who's done it. And that's the peculiarity. And that is what sets up this kind of seismic ripples that continue to shudder out across the world to this day. Because what it does in the long term is to suggest that there is a particular quality in weakness, in suffering. And if Paul stands at one end of this process, then there's another person who stands at his end, who also recognizes just how radical and bizarre this notion was. And that's the philosopher Nietzsche, writing at the end of the 19th century. And Nietzsche, like Paul, says this is madness. Nietzsche, unlike Paul, regrets it. Nietzsche regrets the glory and the power and the glamour and the swagger of the classical world. And he feels that the strong and the mighty have been brought down by what he sees as a kind of sickly pathology. So he wants to see this kind of eulogization of the weak over the strong rejected. And of course, we know, as Nietzsche did not, where that ultimately led.
Did conscience not really exist in the Roman world then? The way, in fact, we're encouraged, and because your point, you go on to develop your point that, you know, human rights, such as we think about it, the whole notion of values, of a reflection on the good life, all of that is a complete outgrowth of Christianity, and that we haven't realised the unbelievable richness of the Christian hinterland, as you say it, as a cultural artefact, not necessarily religious.
Well, people today talk about Judeo-Christianity. But there's a case for saying that actually, it's, if you compare Judaism, Islam, and Christianity, in many ways, it's Christianity that is the outlier, because both Judaism and Islam have an idea that there is a great body of law that has been personally handed down via various prophets, but written by God. And so, if you want to know what you should do, this is what you turn to. Christianity doesn't have that. Again, this idea that conscience is the expression of the law of God serves to make what is distinctive about Western society relative, say, to Islamic civilization. Firstly, that humans make their own laws. They can be guided by what they read in their hearts, but it's humans themselves who make the definitive laws. But also, because the more you look into your heart, the more that enlightenment comes, so also there is a sense that law over the course of the time will become better and better. In other words, that it's progressive. So the idea that, firstly, law should be written by humans, secondly, that it should be progressive, which is pretty fundamental to the way that people in the West think today that law should operate, is absolutely an inheritance of the kind of theological assumptions that actually originate with Paul. And this is, again and again, almost every aspect of Western society, in the, not just the dimension of law, not just in the dimension of morals, but in the dimension, say, of sexuality, in the dimension of marriage, in the way that we conceive of there being something called the secular and something called religion. All these categories and assumptions that we tend to take for granted and assume have always been, we should not take them at all for granted. They are entirely contingent. They are, and pretty much all of them are shaped by this extraordinary kind of supernova, this great explosion, which originates from a tiny, tiny pinprick in the beginning of the first century AD and now has kind of expanded to change the world.
Yes, Tom Holland is my guest, and he's enthralling us with his an account of his latest book, Dominion, where he looks into the real yield of Christianity as a massive underpinning of Western culture, even though it doesn't seem to realise it. This issue that at the heart of Paul's message, you say there's a tension there. He famously says, as you referred to, there is no Jew or Greek. Everyone is equal in the eyes of God. And yet, what happens to those who reject this new way of thinking of his?
Well, yes. I mean, and you fix on the huge problem that has been there right from the beginning. Because, of course, as Paul discovers, there are plenty of Jews who do not want to have their distinctiveness dissolved into a kind of universalist mush, as they see it. And so right from the beginning, the claims of Christian universalism, which we are kind of instinctively feel its nobility because we are all its heirs, whether you're Christian or not, this kind of, we are the world. Nevertheless, it's consistently, right from the beginning, had this shadow of what do you do with people who reject it? And Christianity's relationship with the Jews right from the beginning has been a kind of source of darkness and trouble. I think the Christianity in many ways is kind of rather like the spaceship in the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy that was fueled by paradox, paradox generator. Mm. That's what Christianity is like.
And it's a mystery, one of those, Tom. That's the classic answer.
One of those paradoxes is that Christianity is founded by a man who is tortured to death by a great empire. And many, Paul is, Peter is, or many of the kind of his earliest followers are tortured to death by a great empire. And the idea that the first shall be last and the last shall be first is fundamental to Christianity. The idea that you should love your enemy, that you should turn the other cheek, all these elements. However, Christianity has simultaneously emerged to become the most influential, the most hegemonic way of explaining humanity's purpose that has ever existed. And that dominion, and that's why I use the title, the moral dominion, the spiritual dominion that it's claimed, is also, of course, a geopolitical dominion. And the process of spreading this message of love has often been done at the point of a sword. And that is a tension that has existed throughout Christian history and continues to exist to this day. And it is kind of evident in the way that people who may not consider themselves Christian now, but that, they have values. They may believe in human rights. They may believe in anti-racism. They may believe in combating homophobia. All these kind of ideas. The idea that that those who are oppressed should be defended, you should care for them. Nevertheless, these are ideas that have to be propagated, that have to be brought to people who may not necessarily want them. And so the dilemmas that face a liberal confronted by people who are illiberal kind of echoes, because they are descended from the dilemmas that faced Christians, say, back in the time of Charlemagne, confronting inveterate pagans who didn't want this religion of love, but who were forced to accept it at the point of a sword.
Yes. Well, I mean, the growing view in a lot of circles is that the message, Constantine and his mother, basically changed the whole history of the Christian message when it was accepted as the state power, and that without that taking in right into the body of a great power, it would have been a very different type of message. It would have been a very different movement, I suppose. I just wonder whether you do believe it was fundamentally altered when it too had to learn to wield power.
Up to a point, I don't think it's quite as decisive as people traditionally have thought. And the reason for that is that there is something that's hardwired into Christianity right from the beginning, which is a sense of there being a division between the world of man and the world of God, the city of man and the city of God, as Augustine famously phrases it. But it's something that goes back to the story of the people trying to trick Jesus by asking him whether people should pay taxes to Rome. And he takes the coin and asks whose head is on the coin, and they answer Caesar. And so he famously says, render unto Caesar what is Caesar's and render unto God what is God's. And in the 5th century, when a century after the time of Constantine, the great imperial capital of Rome itself is sacked by the Goths, there are many Romans who have not been brought to accept Christianity who say, this has happened because we have neglected the ancient gods, and specifically because we have neglected the religiones that bind us. And a religio means a binding, and it's a kind of insurance policy that you take out against disaster. You sacrifice something to a god, and in return, the god will look after you. Augustine says no, because there is only the one religio which binds us to the radiant eternity of God. Everything else, human life and imperial powers, and even Rome itself, are born upon the flux of what he calls the cyclum. And the cyclum is the span of living memory. So essentially it means everything that is born and lives and dies. And so Rome, like an individual human life, it will in due course be borne away on the great river of time. And so Augustine, great church father, writing in Latin as the Roman Empire in the West is collapsing, sets up this crucial dichotomy between the dimension of the cyclum, which is flux, and the dimension of eternity that's there in the city of God, which humans can enter through the religio that the church provides. And over the course of subsequent Christian history, this sense of a division between the cyclum and religio becomes fundamental to the way that Latin Christendom sees itself. And in the 11th century, it gets weaponized so that emperors and kings, who, like everybody across the entire span of Eurasia, had always taken for granted that if you have an earthly rule, then you have a stake in the dimension of the supernatural as well. You know, that's something that's true from Japan through India, through China and India, into the Islamic world and Byzantium. Everybody assumes that if you're a king, you have the absolute right to kind of have a stake in the supernatural realm as well. But the church in the 11th century says, no, you belong to the cyclum, you know, back off.
And kings, which is staggering in itself, isn't it, really?
Yeah, so emperors kneel in the snow, kings are whipped through the streets of Canterbury. And over the course of the Middle Ages, this idea of there being what we could, you know, in English comes to be called the secular and religion, gets embedded. And with the Reformation, it comes to be refined even further still, because in the Middle Ages, the dimension of religio is particularly associated with those who devote their lives to God, say monks, nuns, friars, whatever. With the Reformation, that gets democratized. Everybody has religio. Everybody has religion. So in the Protestant English-speaking world, religion comes to mean something that you personally believe. It's your personal relationship with God. But because it exists in the context of the secular, it also comes to mean something that is distinct from the secular space. So this idea that there are kind of whole dimensions where religion doesn't intrude, commerce or law or whatever, This is a way of seeing the world that, say, the British then export around the world. They export it to India. They export it to the Islamic world. But it's an entirely culturally contingent way of understanding things.
But it's
bread
also
of theology,
sort of constant,
bread of history.
Constant revolution. It's really reforming itself all the time, isn't it? It doesn't stay stable.
Yes.
See, I want to ask you about Christianity's long and complicated history with slavery. It's just a sort of a subpar of this. I mean, how, on the one hand, was, say, the Bible used to justify slave owning, and then on the other, to support the abolition of slavery? I mean, this is just a development of this amazing, well, yin and yang, dare I say, you're talking about.
Well, notoriously, nowhere in the Bible does it say that slavery should be abolished. The Bible assumes that slavery is like disease or poverty or hunger. It's just something that humans are heir to in the fallen world, and, you know, it will always exist. And Christian slave owners, therefore, are kind of encouraged to be kind to slaves, to free slaves, but there's never an assumption that slavery itself should be abolished. But having said that, you know, there are certain Christians who do start to ask themselves this. And one of them is a bishop in 4th century Cappadocia in what's now Turkey, a man called Gregory of Nyssa, who looks at the fate that Christ had suffered, the fate of a slave, and asks himself, well, does this mean then that slavery itself should be abolished? And he says, yes, it should. This is so radical a position that no one really accepts it. People say, well, you know, if we abolish slavery, what will happen to the poor slaves? And so he is a kind of outlier. But that idea that because Christ was a slave, therefore slavery in itself is problematic. It's like a kind of a flame that lies underneath, kind of deep buried in the ground, waiting to ignite. And what ultimately serves to ignite it are two things. One is, in the 17th and 18th century, a distinctively Protestant way of understanding how the Spirit manifests itself in the heart, this kind of Pentecostal flame that enables the believer, when he or she reads Scripture, to penetrate to what the true meaning of Scripture is. So the surface line is irrelevant. What matters is what the Spirit is prompting you to understand those lines to mean. And the other thing simultaneously is that in the North Atlantic world, slavery is coming to be racialized. The slaves who are working in the plantations in the Caribbean and North America increasingly are coming from Africa. And although there are Christian attempts to justify this, they are very, very stretched and nobody really takes them seriously, because everybody who is Christian knows that if there is no Greek or Jew, then there is no black or white. And that the notion that every human being has been created in the image of God and therefore has a dignity by virtue of that is so fundamental to what it is to be a Christian that it starts to increasingly prey on the consciences of slave owners, Protestant slave owners. And they look in the Bible, and because they have this distinctive understanding of the Spirit, they are able to convince themselves that actually the Bible is opposed to slavery, even though in many ways it's saying the opposite. And so it begins with a kind of few eccentric Quakers at the end of the 17th century. And a century on, it has become this great blaze that has ignited a mass movement that by the time Napoleon is defeated, obliges the British Foreign Secretary to go to Vienna to negotiate with the other European powers. And he has to say, look, guys, we've got to abolish slavery because the electorate back home are basically making me do this. Mm. And it's the most remarkable kind of moral transformation. And now we live in a world where everybody takes for granted that slavery is wrong. But even 200 years ago, that was very much a minority position.
Yes. Now, look, I think I have time for one more question. I remember post-war, one of the big developments and which caused great grief to a range of popes was that the emerging Europe, the European Constitution, would not consciously endorse its Christian heritage. And I remember Pope Benedict was just devastated. I think still to this day sort of says this was a turning point for him, that something so obvious could not be acknowledged. Now, do you think, as religion is under gigantic pressure in the West, what future do you think Christian values have? This great corpus that you're describing, does it still matter? Does it have a future? Can it reinvent itself?
Well, I think that the way that the preamble to the European Constitution, and it never actually went through, but it kind of said that we are the heirs of Greece and Rome and we are the heirs of the Enlightenment, leaving
That's
out
right.
quite
That's
a
right.
substantial sweep. And the reason they had to do that is that the Enlightenment itself is an expression of profoundly Christian assumptions. So at the heart of Christianity is the idea that the people who walk in darkness have to be brought into light, that idols have to be overthrown, that superstition has to be banished. That derives from the Hebrew prophets. It's manifest in the way that Christian evangelists in the early centuries spread the message, spread the gospel. It's clearly there in the Reformation. Protestant reformers see the Church of Rome as the embodiment of idolatry and superstition, which has to be banished. All that happens in the Enlightenment is that these ideas and convictions and ideals get turned against Christianity itself. But all the guiding assumptions of the Enlightenment remain deeply and irrevocably Christian. Now, the reason why in Europe And I guess in Australia too, and America, there's a kind of problem with acknowledging this, is that in a multicultural society, as Europe has become, the idea that the European values like secularism, like human rights, are not actually universal, but are culturally contingent and specifically a derivative of Christianity, becomes hugely problematic if you are trying to convince non-Christian citizens, Jews, Muslims, Hindus, whoever, that these values are neutral, that it can hold the kind of the ring equally. So in a sense, you have to bury it, because otherwise you're kind of putting your hand up and saying that actually these are these are not universal values.
All right. Well, look, you just prompt me to think on so many levels, but I can't keep you for any longer. So thank you so much, Tom. And look, what an incredibly ambitious undertaking, which you, of course, as usual, have pulled off. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
And if you are looking for a really big book to keep you company at this time, I do recommend Tom Holland's opus, Dominion, The Making of the Western Mind by Hachette.